This is episode 5, and today I'm joined with Keith Cooper, who is a fellow Leicester photographer and YouTuber, but from a very different genre of photography. But I'm going to let Keith introduce himself, what he does, what his business is, and all that good stuff before we dive into a whole heap of subjects, including technical cameras. We're going to talk about review gear. We're going to talk about free camera gear. We're going to talk about business models and how they differ depending on what you're shooting. So we kind of shoot the same but different in a weird kind of twilight world. And we're also going to talk about photography YouTube as well, because we both do that. So I'll let you introduce yourself first.
Hi, I'm Keith Cooper. My business, which people tend to know about, is Northlight Images. And that's because I've been doing it for about just over 20 years. And I, right up front, I decided I was going to write articles and do reviews. And it was part of that. And that got me known quite a lot. In fact, I was originally known for setting up the very first Canon Rumours pages, long before all the xyzrumours.com sites even existed. But by my day job, I'm a commercial photographer, so no weddings, no funerals, no babies, no pets, no events, no handing giant checks over these days either. But in sort of stuff I do is architecture and industrial. Now, I do bespoke training and things as well, but there's all sorts of stuff. But the main areas is architectural photography, industrial, which are quite similar since, you know, you do them on location. Kind of kit I photograph, you couldn't even get in this studio. So it's a lot of big machinery.
Yeah, and so which year did you start in? Was it
2004.
So you were starting your photography career as I was starting my sports science degree. So very, very different world. How has it changed since back then? What's different?
Well, I started off, my first professional camera was a Canon 1DS, first full-frame camera, 11 megapixels.
Was that the CCD or the CMOS?
No, that was CMOS. CCD was the earlier 1D and versions of that, but this was a CMOS, and Canon were the first people able to produce stepped masking and produce full frame sensors. There were a few others, the Kodak ones and bits and pieces, but it was when you took a camera along and you said, this is 11 megapixels. Of course, it's the size of a house brick anyway.
Yeah.
It's a one series. This is 11 megapixels and it's full frame. People would go, ooh, and it impressed people. But because of my background in all sorts of stuff, IT, engineering, various stuff of that, I understood digital and I understood the technology, and I realized that the massive transition that was going on from film, I was still told by people, digital's got no real future.
Yeah,
great, love it. Yeah, you stick with that. I wonder how they are these days. But anyway, it was that move, and I had a real genuine business advantage by understanding the digital technology.
And I think the today's equivalent is making sure you can shoot moving image at the same time as stills.
Yes.
And everyone going, oh, I'm not going to bother with video or animation or something.
Yeah, like, that's
the current equivalent of, oh, digital, probably not for me. We'll stick with film.
Yeah.
And what I find really fascinating is, though, so at the point that the 1DS full frame was groundbreaking, it was in effect an image quality step down, but a convenient step up, which is the exact same thing which is happening now with us doing videos as stills photographers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Obviously, I'm not as good as a DOP, but it's convenient.
Yeah.
And being able to be convenient is, as well as being good, of course, but like convenience plays a huge factor. Like
makes all the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I've got a job to do and something lets me do a particular aspect of it in 5 minutes rather than 50 minutes.
Yep.
That's worth paying for, and it's worth taking the time to learn and do that. Because coming as I do from a sort of scientific background, research background, I was always interested in just going that bit further in the technologies. So just to see. And, you know, you mentioned we'll talk about reviews and things, and one of the ways I got into reviews was because there was all this new kit that was coming in and there was no way I could afford it. But if I could get a name for doing reviews, people would let me borrow it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you're going to know this or not, but do you know every single camera you've had since the 1DS? Can you recall?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What was your...
1DS
line of
1DS Mark III.
Yeah.
5DS.
Yeah.
Because Canon never bought out of S version of the 1DX, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I gave up waiting. And then because Canon couldn't bring out an S version of anything else, I've now got a GFX 100S.
Yes, because for those who don't, I believe this is right, correct me if I'm wrong, I know very little about kit, but the S version was always the
studio.
Yeah. Like the, not the press version of the 1DX series was all press orientated, although to be honest, with the increases in probably image quality, it would have been good enough for studio work for sure. Yeah. But it wasn't a dedicated studio camera, whereas before they always had full frame for the studio and then...
APS-H.
Yeah, that was it, the weird crop, the 1.3.
1.3 crop factor.
It's like, which is kind of a good, I think, middle ground, really, if you're shooting fast stuff.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. So, yeah, I had a similar... Originally I had like a cheap 450D that I borrowed. Then I purchased a 50D, which cost me like something nuts, like £800. Quite expensive. I was secondhand, of course, but like it was quite expensive. And then I went from that to the 5D Mark I, which was a huge jump in image quality for portrait work.
5D Mark I, pretty much identical to the 1DS.
Yeah, beautiful skin tones, but difficult in post.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not the same as shooting slide film, but you kind of got what you got. There wasn't a great deal of play. Then I went to the 5D Mark II, which was just groundbreaking. For everything, so I was shooting portrait. I was the jobbing photographer, did weddings, events, portrait, anything which was paying me money.
Yeah.
And that I've still got one on the table back there, which still works. And we actually shot it on a shoot last week because I wanted to see how much. Because I shot my first worldwide campaign, and I remember it vividly because the fee I got for that one day was more than I'd made in my entire career up to date. And it was the first time I'd sold anything in perpetuity, which I didn't. I had to Google it first. And we tried it against the Fuji. Now, I've not actually compared the images yet. I've looked at them on separate computers because we uploaded them in a different way. But it's still functioning. Then I went 5D Mark II to the 5DS and 5DSR. I had two of each because some of the stuff we shoot, one was clearly better and then sometimes it caused an issue.
Yeah.
I can't remember which way around it was. One was missing a filter or something. Yeah, so every now and again, it's like, if you'd had that shirt on.
Sorry, my techie hat going on there. Yes, the R version had an anti-aliasing filter, but it had a second filter to try and partially cancel out the first one.
That was it. And one was notably sharper. Although, after all the post-production, probably didn't actually matter.
That's why I bought a 5DS. Friend came around, I'd got a 5DS to test. He came around with a 5DSR. We put a TSE 50 lens on it, which is incredibly good lens, just as a straight 50. And we shot some pictures in the street, looking across at buildings, across just some straight pictures, took them in, opened them up, and, he was a bit miffed that he'd paid an extra £300 for it.
Because they were more expensive, weren't they?
Yeah. I saw that as a sort of forum tax for all the people on forums who were saying, this is much better. I thought, right, good. That was a splendid move from Canon marketing.
It's very clever. Exactly. I'm actually surprised they did something so niche to differentiate a model.
But they've produced the astronomical versions of it, which have different filtering to make the sensors more sensitive to the deep reds of hydrogen alpha emissions. So if you're doing astrophotography and you want to record the deep reds that you get from hydrogen emissions, the normal sensor, there'll be a roll-off at that. But the A version, which was available for some cameras, still is, I believe, that would give you an extended red response. Now, it would mess up your skin tone.
No good for me back then.
But if you want to take pictures, deep sky pictures, it was specific for that.
I see. So, I think the thing now is this, obviously, as digital photography's been along for so long, there are so many camera models. And people always go, which camera shall I buy? I was like, if you've got less than a grand, buy a 5D Mark II. If you've got a grand, buy a 5DS.
Yeah.
If you've got more, buy some lenses. Yeah. Like, you can get, like, obviously, we both shoot the same physical camera body. We'll talk about that later. But, and then we both made the same jump from 5DS to Fuji.
Yeah.
And when did you make the change?
Only last year. Basically, I got fed up with the 5DS was great, did a lot of stuff. I looked at an R5, Canon lent me one to have a play with for a while. And in terms of the work I did, and I always qualify this, that my choices are based on the kinds of work I do.
Yeah.
And that in that respect, the R5 was not so much better. Yes, you could process the files better. Then I looked at the GFX Fuji lent me one to have a play with and some of their lenses. But I got an adapter and tried some of my Canon lenses on it. And I thought, even if, and I did this on a shot the other, on a shoot the other day, I used an old EF 2470 2.8L.
Yep, I've got that lens in my fridge. What's it called? Humidifier. I don't put my cameras. Yes. Don't put your cameras in the fridge.
yeah, I used that one, and I used the GFX in crop mode, so 35mm crop mode, and it's still giving me 65 megapixel thereabouts equivalent.
Didn't even know you could do that.
So you can put that in crop mode and use it just normally. Now, I don't need AF very much, yeah. So the fact that it's a bit slow and clunky doesn't really matter with adapted lenses, but that does depend on the adapter you're using. So I do that, and I'm using this lens. I'm getting better pictures because they're much better for post-processing. I find the GFX, I can do far more with them post-processing than I could the 5DS if I need it. And for architecture, that's typically bringing up shadows without blowing out the skies. Because, you know, clients tend to want nice skies if there's a nice sky there. But to capture, you could do two shots, but, you know, to capture that and bring out detail, then obviously the modern sensors are just that bit better.
Yeah, I mean, the main advantage we have is in post-production is drawing masks. Yeah. When you've got 100 megapixels... You can zoom in closer, and you can get a nicer mask.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's one of those things that no one would ever really comment on, I think, on a YouTube camera review.
No.
But like, if you've got more pixels, you can mask better.
Yeah, I have, over the years, the number of people have said, you don't need all those, what do you need all those pixels for? Because typically on a job, I might send JPEGs off to a client, full quality JPEGs, but typically 4,000 pixels wide. Yeah. And they're going, well, why are you producing these huge images? Because when you take huge images and reduce them down, the quality just looks that little bit.
Yeah, it looks a bit crisper. See, it's interesting. We deliver. We deliver very big files. We deliver 16-bit TIFFs.
Yeah.
At least at full resolution, if not sometimes supersized.
Yeah.
Using the lovely new AI features, which actually work now.
Yes,
And then the other format we deliver is PSB, which is the big version of PSD, and we deliver it because a lot of the time the client wants to be able to have, say we've shot something in three variations or three different backgrounds, they want to be able to flip through them quickly. Mm. So we deliver a user-friendly, we don't give them the actual editing file.
No.
We compress that down, so the file's there, but then we'll probably separate the background layer. So if they're doing a new branding thing and it needs to be on blue, they can just click the blue and we've got all their brand colours beneath it. Yeah. So it's all neatly laid out in like a manageable asset they can use straight away. And they seem to really appreciate that. But all of our clients want more resolution at the moment because they're just like, we're shooting. What for? Don't know.
But
we need the content. Can you make sure we can have all of these different crops? And we're like, we have to shoot the item quite small so it fits on a phone screen, which is the nightmare. So it sounds daft, like on a phone screen, it should be like low res, but it's not because you've got to extend it so far and have it, you know, so small in the frame. And move my mic a bit clunky. There we go. It's one of those really difficult sort of aspect ratios to shoot for. But yeah, I think the Fuji is a good bang for buck. However, I've never met a camera with so many bugs and so many problems and such poor usability. And I now represent some like top photographers, and one of them is using a phase for the first time.
Yeah.
And they've always used a different brand of medium format. And I was like, you're having a phase because we're not having that Fuji on set.
Yeah.
The Digitech they'll just go mental.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, how do I use a phase? I was like, there's four buttons.
Yeah.
One of them does ISO. Set it to 100. The other ones don't touch.
Yeah.
And it works. Yeah. Like, that's everything. That's the whole camera in a nutshell.
All you need for it. Yeah.
Took me a day to get my features to work.
This one here, I did a job recently. I do occasional, really small, small-scale macro for some electronic companies, and they're typically chips. These chips may be a millimeter square with writing on them.
Gosh.
now, this needs a relatively specialized approach, stacking, obviously, and things like that. And I had to do a job recently because it's the sort of stuff somebody just calls me up and says, oh, we've got a new design. Can you just do a couple of shots of this? Yeah, no trouble. And I ended up actually using the 5DS on the macro rail I'd got, sort of motorized macro rail, purely because good old Fuji here is such a pain to shoot tethered.
if you want some good tethering advice, you basically have to throw money at the problem. You can only use an Area 51 tether cable. Nothing else will sustain it. Yeah. You can't. Everyone's like, if you get a Fuji, you don't have to bus power it because it will charge it whilst tethering. You've got to turn that off because that stops it from working.
Yes.
And then there's a special order of settings that must be just so. Yes. Otherwise, the whole thing stops.
Yes.
And yeah, it shouldn't be that. Like, it's not. Well, it's not designed.
Yeah.
For what we use it for, really.
No.
It is designed. I think it's a very clever camera in that they've gone, look, we've got medium format here. And it's not really medium format. It has got 16-bit colour depth. It's like the Blackmagic I filmed video on.
Yeah.
It does everything you need it to do, but the usability is lacking.
Yeah.
But, you know, great bits of kit nonetheless.
Yeah, I've got a micro lens for this that I've been testing for months to try and get good results for. This does different sections, and it's a Lauer one, and Lauer do some fascinating kit. But this one has got different settings. I've got a 10, 20, 30, and 50 times magnification. And this is a medium format lens. It's G-mount.
Right.
So the challenge is, this is why I've been challenged. I had to build a new macro rig to put this lot on just to test this lens. Now, it turned out useful for work as well, but the stuff you say about, I've got a Mac Studio I got recently it's the one that is always powering stuff in my YouTube reviews, and that if I used a particular cable from a particular port on it, lo and behold, the tethering worked.
Yeah.
Do I know why? Not really, but it worked. So I wrote it down, and
That's the setup for that. Yeah, it's frustrating. But then, I mean, what we're looking at to get into a phase system, 25,000-30,000.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, we just rent them for each shoot. We don't bother buying that sort of kit.
One of the bits, you rent kit, whereas I've always taken the attitude that because of the kind of stuff I do, I need to know the kit I've got inside out.
Yeah.
And you don't get that from renting. You can. It depends on what you're doing. But in general, it's partly why I've done all the articles and reviews over the years. Because the first review I did was in 2004, so 20 years ago. And it's still valid review. So, and looking at stuff like that, it's just so much that would get me practice with things. You might notice I occasionally review bits of software. Typically, it's because I think this software could be really useful to me.
Yes.
So in process of writing a review and now doing the videos as well, in the process of doing that is the practice to learn how to use it.
I think one of the things I don't do is test kit, and it's probably you leave money on the table almost, because you can only do so many, there's only so many hours in a day. You've got to go, this is what I'm going to focus on. And I don't think I'd ever taken a picture with the Fuji before buying it. But there was no other camera that had the specification I wanted at the price point.
I borrowed it. So, it was enough. I borrowed it with a collection of lenses. And this is one of the nice bits about it. You can just go, I'd like to have a look at such and such. Why, certainly. And that gives me enough experience to know, is this really going to make a difference to what I do? And this one does for the architectural work. This is where I've noticed the difference in this. Some might say, is it a difference your clients notice and stuff? Well, one did a few weeks ago, and that, to me, that justified it.
Yeah.
But,
You see, I recently had a client notice something, and it was lighting related rather than actual camera related, but they noticed my new modifier. I'd just spent, I think it was £1,500 on it. And they're like, oh, those shadows are beautiful. And I was like, thank God. It wasn't just me who thought they were good. So I'm going to quickly adjust the camera because it looks like we've got brighter in here since we started.
Oh, yes. Bit of blue sky.
Yeah. Oh, no. Now I can feel a sneeze coming on as well. This will be deafening down the microphone. I've never spent much time... Well, no, that's not true. When I started my career, I spent a disproportionate amount of time reading reviews and all the rest of it. And in hindsight, I feel like I've wasted a lot of time. I think I could have spent that time better on marketing, on photography.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was an avid reader of forums. I was like, always like, oh, this one here looks really good. Maybe I should. And most of the time, this is what's really stupid about this period of my life. I couldn't even afford the camera.
Yeah.
I'd be reading a review and be like, yeah, that's exactly what I need.
Yeah.
Look at my bank balance, -£750.
Yes. That move to Hasselblad isn't happening.
Yeah, it's not happening anytime, you know, soon. But on the flip side, I would never have assumed I'd be able to afford all the stuff I have today. And it goes from it being completely unobtainable. Like, when I started out, the thought of buying a secondhand 5D Mark I was like, that's never going to happen in my career. I'm getting paid £200 a job here. And then suddenly you get paid £500 a job. And so, I can afford one of these after one job's work. So that's how much they were back then.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, now I'm getting paid this much, I can afford this for a job, you know. And then it's like, oh, do you know what? I need to go and buy all new lighting. And whereas buying my first two lights, I had to take a loan out because I didn't have any money, but I need, in hindsight, it was a bad way to do it. But now it's just like, oh, I need some more lights, go and buy them. Mm. And it seems really like out of reach when you're starting out. I'm sure you have the same thing when you start out 20 years ago. That first 1DS must have been a big purchase.
The secret is how did I afford to do this and go in bang from the start and do that? And the secret was that I've got a lot of previous careers, but the particular one was business consultancy, change management, introducing technologies and how they change companies when they merge and whatever. Microsoft, and I've been a Mac user for far longer than this, Microsoft actually paid me to do some consultancy work for the UK government at what even today I would call a ludicrous day rate.
This is
20 years on. I was told not to wear a suit. If I wanted to look smart, wear a sports jacket or something like that.
Yeah.
Don't wear a suit. That put the money into the company because the company that I would set up that I was using for that anyway, for the business, that put the money into the company to actually be able to go, right, what do I need as a minimum to start with? I want this, 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 and this.
My question is, say you'd have I started this with 1 month's salary in my bank account, how would you have done it then? And how would it have changed your start into the industry?
I would have perhaps questioned whether it was a wise move.
Yeah, in hindsight, mine wasn't a wise move. I took on a studio as well at the same time. I was like, let's just go on.
I definitely was not going to go that route. I would have had to have been much more careful in getting stuff. I probably would have got something a bit smaller. But I thought, this kit, they say buy cheap, buy twice. I went for as much as I could get there.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair as well. Now, Microsoft also paid off my mortgage, so that's another...
Having lower overheads makes
Once you've got that, makes it much easier. But it takes a lot of the pressure off you.
Yeah.
Because then you can think... And I seriously looked at it and said, right, this business, if it doesn't break even after 18 months... 18 months is enough that I can hide that away on my CV and I can go back to whatever. After 18 months, I'm starting to burn bridges. So it was always a dipping in to see.
Sorry, everybody. I'll cut that out. Sorry.
So it was always a dipping in to see
what to do.
Now, it took 15 months before the company bank account came back up again and then off it went. Now, it's never zoomed off. It's not something I would recommend to people to do if you want to make a fortune. I could have had many careers that could have made far more over there. But this is the first time I ever did something because I chose that I wanted to do it as opposed to just happening to fall into
it. Yeah, it's like we have to work, so we'll work, but this is more of a... Yeah. So you basically came into it from the exact opposite approach to me. Mine was a knee-jerk reaction to a breakup.
Yeah.
So I'd recently broken up with my girlfriend at the time and my job offered me a pay rise. And I always wanted to be a photographer, but the pay rise was substantial. Mm. And I knew if I took the pay rise,
yeah,
I would never leave. Thankfully, I now out-earned that pay rise. Otherwise, I might have been having some second thoughts. But yeah. Because I decided on the day of being offered it, I was like, I'm handing him a notice.
Yeah.
And obviously, my boss was like perplexed. He was like, yeah. I don't understand. Do you want more? And I was like, no.
No, no.
I definitely don't want more.
I don't want it.
I was like, I'm going to go do my own thing. And he was like, okay, that was fine. And that first 30 days, I didn't own my house.
Yeah.
I took on a studio as well because I needed it for the work I was doing. Because my first set, we had to build an entire library and we had the drummer from The Who come down and, you know, it was a big shoot for a campaign, which was just pure chance. I didn't have that job at the time of leaving my job. That was just happenstance that came in and luckily covered me for my rent. And my rent was also my rent plus my partner had obviously moved out. So it was like double what it used to be. Although it turned out it was much cheaper living by yourself than with a partner. And, you know, all these things, like it was really stressful. And I would say for 8 years, it was very stressful.
Yeah.
It
was not easy doing that because it meant that there were some things I wasn't going to do, but it was always, I've set it out and I always intended from setting up the business. Now I, with my consultancy and everything else background, research background, I had a proper business plan. Now it was only a couple of sides of A4, but I had a business plan and part of that business plan was to average working no more than one day a week, actual photography work. Yeah. That business plan also said to manage at least a day a week of just experimenting and playing around. And that became the articles and the reviews and everything like that. So they actually come, although people say, well, do you just write this stuff because you can? No, it's part of the business.
Yep.
And it is there to promote the business various ways, but it's there as part of the business. So it was always intentional to do the stuff. So you mentioned about the YouTube stuff just by chance. So likewise. So,
yeah.
But it was always part of the plan to include that.
So my YouTube, this business here, Tin House Studios, which is separate to my photography, it's a separate, this is a limited company, my photographer trader. So people can't see what's coming in and out. So I feel a bit vulnerable with that, but this had to be a limited company for various reasons. Well, mostly because you can't have two sole traders, really.
Yeah.
So this is a limited company. This has a business plan. This has to run like a business. And from the YouTube videos, they seem, well, maybe not fun, but, you know, it doesn't seem like a business on the outside.
No.
But it's a business.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I, like, what was it, Thursday? Wednesday? Wednesday, 3 p.m.
It is Wednesday.
Like...
All day.
Yeah. If this here, and it'll be the same for you, isn't making money...
Yeah.
I financially can't afford not to be working right now.
No.
And it might not be like the AdSense on a podcast like this is like 50 quid. It's barely worth, you know, cashing in. But... if more people know who we are, if more people buy your book, which we'll talk about in a bit, if more people buy my workshops, this is my marketing, really. Yeah. Likewise, you assume you count this as marketing, advertising.
Yes, indeed.
Get people to your channel, get people, you know. This has a business plan. My photography, on the other hand, has no business plan.
Mm.
Well, no, it does. The business plan is be better than everyone else. That is it. There is no... And because of we work in very different fields... Mm. I have to create work that nobody's ever seen before in order to get booked.
Yes.
In order to do that, a business plan does not help.
No.
Now, I have to financially produce these things and make sure, like, it's not like I just go, oh, it's a cha-ching, 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 oh, I'm bankrupt. Like, that, no. The finances are managed by somebody, actually. And a lot of it is very well organised. But there's no plan.
No.
There's no, like, this is how my week will be. It's just, there's no point either. It will never go that way. But it's... I never had a business plan. I always just assumed if I worked really hard, I'd make enough money. and for 8 years I was wrong.
The marketing side of it, and it's probably because of my background in sort of business and stuff like that, was always that I've written about the business side of things for years, and it is what to you and me seems the bleeding obvious, in that you need insurance.
Yeah,
you need to actually look at profit, not turnover.
Oh, every time I ask a photographer, I'm like, how's business going? Oh, I've just made 250 grand. It's like, wow, that's really good. They've made 25 grand profit. I'm like, that's really bad. You've got a lot of liability there.
That's it. And it is that business aspect. And I get the same with people wanting to sell print because of all the stuff I do connected with printing and things. I get people ask, so where's the best place to sell my prints? As if I give you some online thing like that, it'll... And I said, well, where are the people who will buy your prints? Who are the people who will buy your prints? And they look at you some... they have all too often a, if I build it, they will come.
No, attitude. They will not.
No. I think ask any photographer who's been in the business for more than a few years about the if I build it they will come attitude, and you will get that reaction.
No one's coming around here. It's not going to happen.
No.
That's a very good point. I mean, selling prints, for example. I mean, someone recently said, oh, why don't you sell prints, Scott? And I was like, because I need to make money.
I don't like
my audience is a select few art buyers and creative directors and a lot of photographers.
And
unless every photographer wants my work hanging on their walls, which if you do, do let me know, because I'll start making prints, but like that's not going to happen. No one wants my work.
People ask me about big prints because I often test very large printers, large format printers. And yes, I love making big prints. By big, say, 70 inch by 90 inch.
That's where
like
I know
that.
You from. I saw your print at the Leicester Photographic Gallery, which was a huge panoramic print.
40, yes.
That must be like in 2010?
2012. And the print was 47 feet long.
That's it. So we were trying to work out where we knew each other from prior to this. We knew we'd met. That was it. It was a panoramic from the clock tower in Leicester.
Yes. Yeah. It was. But,
I knew it'd come to me eventually. There we go.
Something
12
like
years
that,
ago.
That's a special job.
Yes.
If somebody wants something like that, it's going to take a week or two of my time. It's going to take a lot of planning. It's going to take a luck in the weather and stuff like that. So if somebody wants that, they're going to be paying an awful lot of money for it. It ain't cheap doing stuff like that, because I'm not doing it just because I enjoy it. If I'm doing it for you and you're paying, I want to be paid well for it.
Yeah.
And that's where that comes in. But I occasionally sell large prints to architectural clients, because I've commissioned me for a job for a project or something like that, and I get a picture of it. I think that looks rather nice, and because I happen to have been testing a printer, free ink, free paper makes a big difference. I've gone and produced a print this size, and of course you just go, oh, by the way, I printed one of those pictures I did for you, and right, that's it. Yeah, do you sell them? Yes. And of course, because it's picture taken by you, to have it in the boardroom at a practice or something like that, or there was a local practice, as you went up the stairs in their office, there was just a series of my photos printed on the wall. So, great.
Yeah,
marketing again, but not something that is a core contributor to the bottom line of the business. It is nice, it works as marketing, it might earn a bit of money, and it's fun as well, but that ain't what we're about.
And I think the bit of money thing is a slippery slope people fall into.
Yes.
They're like, I'm making some money doing this. I'm like, but even if you do it 24/7, it's not enough.
Yeah.
So it's great that it's not losing you money, but...
I get people ask about printing because of the printers I test. They say, well, I want to print cards. Is this printer good for printing cards? And you go, okay, yes, it is. You load some card in, comes through. Pre-creased card, out comes, you've got a really nice card. Now, I've tested loads, I've got loads of this paper. I use them for making the occasional Christmas and birthday card for people. Excellent. Okay, you want to make a business of this. First of all, there are no printers which allow you to stack up card.
Yep.
So you've got to feed them one at a time. These printers can be slow, 4 or 5 minutes. So the problem is So what level of producing cards are you going to do for your business? Oh, well, I expect to do hundreds of them.
Yeah, probably not, mate.
not unless you hire somebody to feed paper through it and things like that. And then, of course, there's the other bit that nobody ever thinks about print businesses, is that any volume, and you need volume to make a profit, any volume, it becomes a fulfillment business, not a printing business.
Yeah, yeah. My friend has a printing business around the corner, and he now owns a lorry.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering whether Teddy's squeaky toy there now is scratching himself is going to be a joy for Rob to try and remove, or whether you're going to be enjoying him playing with his dead pheasant squeaky toy. Oh. It's a real, like, I have a lot of photographers. I'm like, well, you need to stop doing that and start doing this, when I do like one-to-ones and stuff. Like, yeah, but this makes me money. I'm like, no, it grosses you money. You're not actually making any money there. It's just,
how much time are you putting into doing this?
Yeah.
What returns are you getting on it? Oh, but there's also the marketing. Okay, have you worked out the ROI on your marketing? At which point you use a phrase like worked out the ROI and they're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was, so to give it a different context, a different scale, I was doing portfolio reviews at £250 a portfolio review. Mm. And I sat down with my accountant and we worked out that it's not worth me doing them.
No. The amount of time, to do a good job.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, it's only an hour. And she was like, is it?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, it's not.
No.
So I've got to look at the work first. I'm not looking at it blind.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've got to do it. Yeah. And then I've got to send an email afterwards with some feedback or whatever it may be. I was like, it's 2 hours. And she went, so you're working for £100 an hour, minus transaction fees, minus marketing fees, £150. You're working at £75 an hour. And she's like, what's your minimum you'll go out to for a day's work as a photographer? And I was like, probably £500 an hour minimum. And she went, is that including prep time? I was like, yeah.
Yep.
That's the whole lot. I won't go out for less than that. And she's like, so why are you doing a whole day's worth of this?
Yeah.
When you could do, like, it's like one day, you have to do 5 days of this to one day shooting.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah.
Do it for someone you know or someone like that that you want to do it for, and do that. I always say, people who ask about when I do specialised training. Now, it's interesting, the building we're in here, a few years ago, a small business in building next door to us, I did some product photography training for them. This is fairly basic level product photography, not this stuff. So we said, well, why do you do this? Surely you're teaching people to do something that you're stealing your own work. And I went, no. I enjoy it. I come from an academic background and research and that, so I enjoy that aspect of it. We charge enough so that we will get a good return on it. And they go, well, what about all the stuff on your website that's free? And I said, well, we have two prices, full price or free.
Yeah.
The free is what you get if you watch one of my YouTube videos or read an article or something like that. The full price is what you will pay if you want me to turn up personally and do it. And there's no sort of doing it cheaper.
No, absolutely.
You pick your price.
Yeah.
It is either free, in which case, as with most things on social media, if it's free, you yourself are the product.
Yeah.
Is the bit. Well, the free bit is, it's bringing me in an income. The full price, it's bringing me in an income.
Yeah, absolutely. I think with, you know, in terms of, like, I'm very keen, it's either it's something I want to do or it's something I'm being paid enough to do.
Yeah.
And if it's not one of the two, I mean, sometimes it's both, but rarely.
Yeah.
It's rare that a client turns up and goes, we want you to shoot this exactly the way you want to shoot it, and we've got a massive budget. It happens once every few years, but most of the time it's either we've got a really cool idea but not much money, or we've got loads of money and a really boring job for you.
Yeah.
What you fancy.
Yeah. I did a product photography shoot for a paper vendor. And that consisted of an entire week at their place with a basic setup, a couple of lights, camera, laptop connected up. And that consisted of packs of reams of copier paper and stuff like that. Now, as it turned out at the time, they paid enough for it that we sort of went, yeah, all right. Okay, we're going to do that. It's been a bit slow. We'll do it. Those couple of weeks, the amount that paid just topped up everything just nicely.
Yeah.
So that's one of those ones where you go, why am I photographing another pack of paper?
But, I mean, I go by the cash cow or portfolio piece ethos.
Yeah.
And I think the important bit is that what a cash cow is at any given time changes.
Yes.
Next week, I am stacked. Yeah. If someone goes, can you shoot this? And they've got less than 50 grand. I'm not even responding.
Yeah.
But 3 months ago and I had no work and someone went, yeah, got 2 grand for you, mate. I'm like, yep, I'm on it. That's a cash, yeah, cow today.
Yes.
Because it's suddenly like, well, yes, you, yeah, know, how...
if you don't accept that that's going to be the way things work,
yeah,
then, well, yeah, it's going to be tricky.
No, absolutely. And so we've got Teddy in the studio today and doggy daycare. And he's looking, I was about to bark at me for some attention. But yeah, no, I think you have to be really on it with that sort of stuff. It is a very fluctuating business in terms of that. And in terms of when the money does come in, like my bank balance usually, it's like it stays the same for a little bit, then it goes down, 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 down. Sometimes for 3, sometimes for 6 months, just going, yeah, down, and then it goes up.
Yeah.
And that might be the only up of the whole year. Some years, yes, it looks, I mean, the YouTube channel is very consistent. That bank, yeah, balance, I can literally, yeah, go, well, do you know what, in 3 months' time, I'll have gained this much more money roughly.
Yes, yeah.
But the photography side of things,
yeah,
in 3 months' time, my account could be like quite empty or it could be really full.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
And that's a real hard thing to deal with in this industry compared to like having a day job.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But I always say, like, at least you know when it's bad. Whereas sometimes, mm, I've got friends who've gone to go into work, they phone me up and they're like, I'm outside my offices and there's a padlock on the door.
Yeah.
And a letter saying we've all lost our jobs.
Yeah.
Like obviously the owners of the company, they knew that was coming for a,
yeah,
year.
Yeah.
Like, and we know when it's going bad. And we're like, yeah, do you know what? Probably not going out for dinner tonight. We'll just, you know, yeah, beans on toast again. But yeah, I think that's, and I think it's a good time to talk about business models. So I think most people listening to this probably know my business model is that I shoot ad campaigns for, mm-hmm, billboards,
yeah,
for household names. That's it. If I can't do it in a studio.
Yeah.
And well, if it talks, I'm not interested. But if it doesn't talk, it's in a studio, and it's, you know, I probably shoot 3 to 4 jobs a year.
Yeah.
Paid job. I shoot probably 50 times a year, but paid, yeah, jobs, 3 to 4 jobs a year,
yeah,
have an agent and all the rest of it. Now, your model's completely different to,
oh,
this.
Yeah. Yeah.
How does yours, you've just done a job,
yeah,
without disclosing the exact, yeah, figures and stuff. Explain the whole thing.
As an architectural photographer, I've always reckoned that if you can, yeah, any fool with a good camera and lens can photograph an award-winning building. Just wait for the light to get right and whatever. Yeah, it's
dumb luck will hit it eventually.
Yeah, it's not difficult to do it. The bit where I know that I've had really positive feedback from clients, architects, developers, sometimes property owners and things, and it tends to be commercial properties.
Offices, factories, yeah, banks.
Very much more of that. But it's the feedback from that is you can produce interesting looking pictures of sheds. Now, if you understand the lighting, the editing, all the bits and pieces, the composition, the best that any structure has good views, has not so good views, depending on, you know, as you walk around it. And it really is, I was out, not just this most recent one, but I was out photographing some industrial units. And it just so happened, it was a wonderful day with clouds zooming, a really violent looking sky. And I got some absolutely great shots of what are just silver boxes. But that's the rest of it. But the one yesterday was a bit unusual in that it was a residential property. But I was asked by a specialist manufacturer of window frames, could I just go, because it was relatively local, could I just go and photograph some windows? So this was, it was a new build property. So there's a few shots inside. And these are fairly high-end windows. These are sort of proper wooden sash windows, hardwood, you know, so quite expensive windows. So really it consisted of going into the property, taking some pictures of the windows, taking some pictures of the fittings, opening the windows, taking some pictures, just documenting it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then going outside and taking a load more pictures of windows, plus a few sort of classic architectural ones where everything is dead straight and like that. So using a tilt shift lens or use just shift, obviously, and taking that. And that was it. Now, that was a job that I will, depending on the job, I sometimes will charge by time. sometimes we'll charge by photos produced. I've always had a very simple licensing approach in that you don't pay for processing, you don't buy a license or anything. Now, if it's a big enough company, then yes, I may change it. But for I often work for relatively small businesses and they want simplicity. So you just go, it'll cost you so much. Yeah. That'll cost you 250 quid. I'll nip out, take those photos for you. You'll have them in 3 or 4 days' time. There you go. And that's a morning or something, or not even that.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's more, if it's longer than that, that's a short job. That's one of the ones that. And
do you do multiple jobs in a day sometimes?
Sometimes, but not that often. If I can, the very best jobs are where an architect practice contacts you and says, we've got a whole load of projects that we've finished recently. We've looked at, we're redeveloping the website, and we've realised we haven't got good photos of these. So they will just send a big list. Now, yeah, this could be also property development companies, who commercial properties, who bought a load of properties, and they want photographs of everything in their portfolio. Now, that is great, because my wife, Karen, who does all the, you know, the business side of things and the marketing and everything like that, and looks after the money, which is useful to have someone who appreciates looking after money, she will just go, right, okay, well, tomorrow you're going there, then you're going there, then you're going there. And the reason you're going there is because this one here, the best view is facing east. This one, the best view is facing south. And this one, the best view, yeah, I simplify it.
Yeah.
This one's the best view is facing west. So if you go start of the day, sun's in the east. Middle of the day, it's in the south. End of the day, it's in the west. And that's like a nice circuit.
And I think just coming back to that point, then the previous one you made, like I could go and take a technically good photograph of a building, but I don't know what makes a building good.
Yeah.
And this is where knowing your subject matter is key.
Yeah.
It's like you could take one of my photographs of some junk food,
yeah,
but you don't know junk food like I do. I really know junk food. And it's understanding that
It is
subject matter, because the cameras are not that difficult.
No.
Like even our technical cameras, you can learn it in the morning, if you,
I was told, I used to be, many careers ago, I was a geologist and geophysicist doing survey work. And I got a job with a company. And I was, once I was working with them, I was curious, asking, why did you hire me? And they said, well, actually, it was not the fact that you're a geologist or anything like that. We can teach somebody that very easily for what they need on site, on location, on a boat or whatever, survey boat. They said, what interested us is your background in electronics, in that you can fix a piece of kit that breaks in the middle of nowhere with a gas-powered soldering iron. We can teach geology to anyone in a few days. He said, you cannot teach fault finding, fixing equipment, all of that. So, there was people who'd done sort of similar degrees to me as geologists and things were going, why has he got a job? And I said, it's because I used to repair tellies.
I tell you who's a really good crossover of skills is for assistants is ex-musicians or music techs.
Yes.
Because they understand how not to have a microphone stand fall over. They understand how to put cables away without wrapping them around their arms and snapping them. They understand they're proper over, under cables. Well, you get a photographer in here, they're a nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
And they start asking questions, which is never, never enjoyable.
Yes.
Very different business model. Now, do you or have you ever, and I don't actually know the answer to this, done the thing where you work for a house selling company and you go in and do all the interiors of all the buildings?
No.
Is there a reason why? Because I know a lot of people do that and get stuck in that rabbit hole.
Because they won't pay the rate I want.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough.
It is as simple as that. I have done property brochures.
Yeah.
Now, where somebody wants a large... and they are typically for industrial buildings. So there are several places here in the city where I've photographed them, big buildings, where I've been in them and just produced for a sales brochure. Now, the budget for a sales brochure is very different to the budget for some pictures to go in the front window of a estate agent and on Rightmove or something like that.
And then, so who would be, not always, but, your best paying client type? What is the one which... Because obviously they all want the same thing.
They do. Property
they value it differently.
Property developers.
Property developers are the one.
It is because they are often the ones with the budget. They're the one with the marketing budget. Architects, great to work for, but they don't have the budget.
Yeah.
People think architects, all loads of money. No.
Often, and it's always one building at a time.
It is.
But if you're going to sell 50 houses,
yeah,
you're...
Yeah, I'll go to a new build development or something like that, and walk around the streets, take pictures of the buildings like that, or a property that's going to be up for sale. I've had to go to various towns, and one of the reasons I like this particular one, travelling to various towns in the UK, places I'd never normally have the slightest reason to visit, purely because, as part of a property portfolio, a shop building belongs to this company, and they want some pictures of the shop. To the extent that I'll set up... Now, I'm somebody who likes shooting handheld as well as... I'm not tied to using a tripod always, but I use a tripod for this because I need, over the course of 10 minutes, to take a series of pictures with different people walking past. Somebody in their marketing department will then composite these to produce a huge, great crowd going past.
Yeah.
Because you're selling commercial properties.
They want the footfall.
And you've got the footfall. So I had an interesting, wet Saturday afternoon in Scunthorpe once, just photographing a building, waiting for people.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, it's a good segue here to being a small, what I was calling earlier a small town photographer, but you pointed out you'd lived somewhere smaller beforehand. But like... Does it matter in the UK for what you do, where you're based?
It does some part for the architectural stuff because it is such an expense to work in London that quite often, and there are lots more photographers in London inside the M25, that it is often not even worth us quoting for stuff. However, there is lots of stuff going on outside of London, which we're more than happy to do. I will quite often do things, Leeds, Manchester, things like that.
And do you get paid, assuming you didn't have to travel there, is the day rate or photo or hourly rate higher in London than outside of London?
I think it is. But as I say, I don't know for certain because there is a certain point where I go, how much hassle is this job? Is this job worth it? And there's also a slight problem in architectural photography. If you want your photos to appear in any of the journals or anything like that, you have to be one of the known people.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that seems purely by chance and knowing the right people.
Yeah.
And since I'm not in London, it doesn't really matter what I photograph. It's never going to appear in journals and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's similar in our industry, not in terms of getting into journals, but like if you want to be in the big things, you have to be in the group, in the circle.
Yeah.
And I spent a good decade getting into that circle. And it was, being not from London, it was very difficult. Yeah. And I, whenever anyone ever goes, oh, I want to do commercial photography, I'd like to move to London or New York straight away. Because once you get settled in, you won't be able to stomach the prices of London.
No.
But if you don't know any different,
yeah,
it's just life, isn't it?
Like, it is indeed. As I said, that work for Microsoft that paid for my photography career.
Yeah.
Not entirely in its entirety, but paid was the key funding for the start of it. And that was a few months down in London. And I would go in, stay during the week and come back at the weekends. And I got over my dislike of London, which came from growing up in a smallish town. Never greatly liked it, but it was also the freedom I had in the kind of work I was doing because it was open-ended consultancy work.
Yeah, yeah.
If I chose to visit Tate Modern one afternoon, that was...
Yeah, that is one of the great things about it. I'm back in town next week for a few days in London, and I have a proper routine, and it's probably quite a touristy one, but like I get off at King's Cross, I go to the champagne bar, but not the little standy up one. I go inside because I don't like to be out with the noise and everything. I sort of like regroup there, do my notes, have something to drink, have something to eat. Then I get an Uber because I no longer go on the tube since COVID. Yeah. Because, and I'll go into that in a minute actually why, because people think it's a bit nuts, but it probably is, but it makes sense to me. I get an Uber to wherever I'm going to, do my work, come back to CSEs on the way back and then head back home again. But yeah, so during COVID, when we were all locked down, I didn't get ill once. Now, I'm not just talking about COVID. I'm talking about any illness. And I was like, hang on a second. All these germy folks everywhere.
Where am I picking all this stuff up from?
Yeah. So now my business model differs wildly to yours. You shoot regularly, often, little bits here, little bits there.
Yeah.
And that's what makes up your year.
With occasional gaps of a month or so.
Yes.
So,
yeah. Yeah. But like, I mean, like we'd never do a half day.
Of course.
Shoot.
No.
Because no one wants it in our industry either. But also, you can't hire in, and you work by yourself.
Yes.
I don't even do personal work by myself.
You need,
I mean, we need like, it's too much work. It's too much kids.
Yeah.
And
that was a dilemma. When I said I set up the business model at the time, back in 2004, said, I do not want the studio.
Yeah.
I do not intend to do work that requires assistance. Occasionally, Karen will come along with me, but it's as much because she wants to visit the place.
Yeah.
But she's, I'm not saying it's just a jolly, because she understands photography. She used to do jewellery photography. So she's technically quite advanced
it's
in it.
As well, yeah.
But it's useful for that. But it's a choice you do. And it's one of those things about thinking, what do you actually want to do for your photography? How does your business fit? Do you want to do, and as I say, I do a mix, I'll do the specialist micro photography of that. Well, it's not quite micro, sort of five times magnification.
It's
in that border area of it, but it's certainly stuff that you can't easily see without putting your glasses on. And to do that sort of stuff, that's by choice. But yours is a very different business, but equally, well, it's entirely by choice. And I think that's the thing.
Well, people, interesting you should say that, because I would say the...
Well, now, anyway.
Yeah, I'd say the worst bits about my business... So I keep adjusting the mics, I keep fiddling myself. The worst bits about my business are, one, this place, this studio, costs thousands per month to run.
Yes.
Thousands.
Yeah.
And most of the time, it's just me and my dog in here. Yeah. Apart from maybe, what, 5 days of the... Well, no, there are other people who come and work with me a lot of time. That's one thing. The other thing is crews. Crews cost money.
Ooh, yes.
And that's fine because it's priced into the job. It's not actually... I wouldn't lose money by doing it a different way or gain money by doing it a different way. But one of the things with having a crew is that not only do you have to get the job done, but you have to keep everyone happy so they come back. Because there's always crew work. You can always get an assisting job. You can always assist somebody else. And the day rates are set. Every assistant, the outside of London, $250 a day. The in London, it starts at $350 and goes up.
Yeah.
They can go and work anywhere for that. They don't have to work with you. So if they don't like you, they won't be coming back. Digitex starting rates like $550 a day. You know, good Digitex are like a grand up a day. They're booked. You can never find a Digitex.
Yeah.
If they don't like you, they're not coming to work with you. And that is like an added bit of stress when the shoot's going wrong and you're like, oh my God, I'm about to lose my rag with this person if they don't move that light to the exact spot I wanted to. And you're like, don't do that. They'll never work with you again. Don't be an arse. And that's frustrating. And then going back to the illness thing, having crews, they've come from somewhere else.
Yes.
And everyone's going, oh, Scott, don't be so, you know, ridiculous about it. If the job's £120,000 a day.
Yeah. You don't
and
want
I've got
to be,
a cold.
Yeah.
That could be enough to blow my career.
Yeah.
And it sounds so ridiculous, but like I've been working for, and I say, oh, $120,000 a day, that's brilliant. It's not, because I've done 3 months worth of test shoots to get this job. That's paying for those 3 months of work. Yes. That's not my day's labor.
Yeah.
That's the accumulation of how I got to this point. And if I mess it up on that day, I've not messed up a day, I've messed up 3 months.
Yeah.
And the thing with people who aren't self-employed is they see the day rate as, oh,
yes,
you know, I had a phone call recently with one of my agents and I had a friend in the car and we'll just chat it. And they're like, oh, what's the lowest amount of money going to come out for? I was like, I won't come out to work for less than 10 grand. And my mate was like, are you stupid? I was like, you know, you don't understand.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
In our line of work, we do three jobs a year.
Yeah.
If I do three jobs at less than 10 grand, I'm bankrupt.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do it. I've got, it's not like I know exactly who my client's going to be in 3 months' time because of everything I've done for the 3 months leading up to this.
Yeah.
That client is going to book me.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot on the studio.
Yeah.
Crews coming in for test shoots. Because it's great having the crew paid for on a set. But when I'm doing a test shoot, I still need a stylist, an assistant, a digitech, a researcher as a minimum.
Yeah.
And that's a £2,500 crew coming in just for a test shoot.
Yeah.
And a lot of it never sees the light of day because it's my bad ideas. So that the stress of that, if I look back on it now and I think, could I have done this differently? I wouldn't have a studio, 100%. But now I'm in a position where I can't get rid of it because it's gone too far. Yeah. And the house we live in isn't suitable for what I do because... Yeah. I'm sure your house is very quiet when you're doing YouTube videos. I've got three children, a cat and a dog.
Ah, yes. So. Yes. I'll set stuff up in the video. You know, the kit you're shooting this on here is sort of way beyond what I would use. As I said, I still use an EOS RP with an adapted Olympus OM2 lens, 24mm, 2.8, manual focus. It works a treat.
Yeah.
It does that, set it up. Wireless mic. I don't work. I've tried it. I cannot work to scripts.
No, I can't do scripts. I have one heading and then just ramble.
Yes,
and hope for the
best. That's it. and the one problem I have with that is that I almost have to say each time for a video, errors and omissions accepted, because you will get verbal typos in it.
Oh, I can't remember what I said recently, but it was literally the opposite of what I meant.
Oh yes, yeah,
and. I do that all the time.
But you then get a comment on it that says, and they give a timestamp in the video. You said such and such at that. Is this, and you think, what? Hang on, let me find that video. Let me find the, what am I talking about? And it sort of get yourself back in the, oh, right, okay. Oh, that's what I'm, oh, yes, yeah, sorry.
Because I have the thing where, like, the video that comes out today, for example, I could have recorded 2.5 months ago.
Yeah.
I've got no idea what I've said.
Yes.
I'm sure at the time I thought it was good, otherwise I wouldn't have edited it. Because I film a lot of videos and never edit them. I get back to them and get into the editing suite and I'm like, that's rubbish. Yeah. Just delete that one.
Yeah.
We do it as one takes. I literally set up this camera, the microphone's on it at the right distance. We've got an audio preset, editing preset. Now I've got a podcast table set up on wheels. We can wheel it out the way at the end. It's all about efficiency.
It is.
Do like 8 to 10 videos in one day.
Yeah.
And that's it for the month. Done.
Yeah. I try and do 2 or 3 at a time. I have on my desk when I'm doing my normal work, I have a sheet of paper that is just there for ideas.
Yeah.
If somebody emails me and asks me a question because, I bring this upon myself because I do say questions welcome.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is worth it at the moment because if the answer goes to a longer than a paragraph, I will jot that down as an outline for a video because if my answer takes, 10 lines of text, that's a 15-minute video.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how it's interesting, this might be not interesting for others, or maybe if you're into YouTube, it will be interesting for you. How do you record... Do you have a method for your... let me go through... I will tell you how I do my videos. Yeah. I don't even know the words to explain what I'm trying to say. Sure. So, for example, I'll come up with a video going, I'm going to make a video about my technical camera.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to, before I even make the video, I need a title and a thumbnail idea. Because if I don't have a good title and thumbnail, it will never go past 10,000 views. And if it doesn't go past 10,000 views, I've wasted my time. Financially.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. So I'll take that. It depends on how long, but I don't have time. I absolutely do not think of a title and a thumbnail.
You do it reverse. Okay.
They are almost the last thing. Once I know what it's about, what's in it, and which bits I think are a bit of a hook.
Yes, that's the next bit. So I get my title because if it can't make a good package... The video can be as great as... I've made videos before, this is a brilliant video, and I've not bothered with time spent on the, 5,000 views. I'm like, what a waste of time. Because the content's good, but I've packaged it badly.
Well, YouTube has a problem as well. For me, partly this is my academic teaching background coming out again, is that it is dreadful for curating collections of stuff and indexing.
Yeah.
So that last year... I went through all the videos I'd created and created a comprehensive index page on my website that if you want to know what I've done about colour management of a particular sort, you can go there and it'll have all the things done of that. It was a lot of work to do it. But now I update it every time something new, so it's no longer a lot. But it was a good 2 or 3 days' work to do that. And I'm thinking, YouTube is absolutely useless at curating collections of work.
Yeah, that's not what they want, though, is it?
That's not what they want. They want the now.
Hookability.
They want...
Hookability, is that a word?
Well, yeah, sounds pretty close to what they're about.
It's just fine. You've got to play the game, haven't you, I think? Yeah. And I get a lot of flack for my titles and... It's like, oh, that's not what the video is about. I'm like, well, it is. But if I said what the video is about, 99% of the photographic population don't even understand what I'm about to talk about. So how would they know they need to click on it?
The one I did recently, which to me is the closest I ever dared go to clickbait, was about the shocking truth about desktop printers.
Yeah.
And the shocking truth is they're actually very good, and if you can't produce great photos from them, it's your fault.
Yeah. But if you'd have called that, desktop printers are good.
Yeah.
Which is what people who are watching it, it's like, no one's going to click on that.
No.
Now, I do agree you shouldn't clickbait and go, like, I've sold all my cameras when you've actually not.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's a bit... Yeah. Well, unless you have, you're going to talk about the selling process and, you know... But yeah, without the right packaging, and again, I have a business model for my YouTube thing. And if it doesn't, basically, I already have a job as a photographer, which is very all encompassing. I work as an agent. I represent four international photographers. That takes up a lot of time. If I'm going to take time away from my kids, I want pay. If it doesn't make me money, I can't turn around to the boys and go, look, I'm not available this Sunday because I'm filming YouTube videos.
Yeah.
Oh, do you make money doing that? No. I've just chose to not spend time with you. Like, it's got to have, like, you know, and people are, oh, you're just doing it for the money. And it's like, well, I'm not just doing it for the money, but without the money, I can't justify it.
No.
Like,
it is, it's interesting that you take that approach to it, because YouTube for us is part of our marketing budget.
Yeah.
Goes that. So budget in time as well as resources. Resources aren't much for it, but it is for time and that. And it's got to a point where later this year, well, early next year, I think it'll probably hit 50,000, which is probably about 49,000 more than I ever thought would be.
Yeah.
I only took up doing YouTube videos because a guy from Canon UK, I was looking at a printer and done all this stuff, written reviews for ages, and a guy was asking me about, and he said, can you do a video? And I went, no, I don't do videos. And it's literally during lockdown, this was, guy from Canon twisted my arm into doing some videos, and that has taken off. And it's going to reach a point where I actually think, okay, this is now growing nicely. What do I seriously want to do with it? And I'm reaching that point. Yeah. We're just shy of 40,000 at the moment. And it's at that point where it becomes work. Now, where do I want to take that? How does it fit in the business? Now, the fact that I enjoy doing it is great for the time being.
Absolutely.
But at a certain point, it goes over from, yes, it's great, but actually this has to be part of a proper business as well.
Yeah, it's like, well, this podcast now is my current version of that. I enjoyed doing the podcast. I get to get different people on. We did one actually, which is just my workshop, so you do have to actually pay to see that one, because we had the senior creative director from Sky in London come down.
Oh, right, yes.
And like, fascinating. We chatted for like 2 hours this morning, which is why we're doing this now, because we're already set up and good to go. And eventually I'm going to get to the point where I'm like, if I'm going to sit down for 2 hours a week and talk...
Yes.
Where's that time or money coming from? Yes. I need a sponsor for the podcast.
Yes.
And, you know, to make it work. If I don't have a sponsor, we're going to have to shut it down. But I didn't start it just to make, like, it's not like, because I always sound really mercenary. I'm like, well, if it's not going to pay me money, I'm not doing it. But I only have 24 hours in the day.
Yes.
There's only one of me. Yeah. There's three children. There's a partner. There's my mum. There's my grandma. There's always other people who, you know, deserve to be respected in their time. I can't just, you know, do everything for free. And I've done very well at making YouTube work as a financial endeavor. I won't say how much it makes, but I'll type down here how much I make a year from YouTube last year.
Let's see.
Yeah,
that's a nice number.
And
that
number justifies the amount of time, effort and money I put into it, having a editor on site, having guests come in. But if I didn't do it and I just posted YouTube videos only and didn't do all the other stuff around it, this is how much I make.
Yes,
after
indeed.
All the expenses.
Yes.
So it's by making it into a business that I can do YouTube
and
basically for free.
And that's the point where mine has got... Yeah, it was a great thing in lockdown.
Yep.
It was there. It's got there. It's done fantastically better than I ever thought it would be, and I've enjoyed it. But there comes a point, now it needs reintegrating into the business.
Exactly. Because people think that YouTube, because you get monetized on YouTube, they think you make good money from it.
Yes.
Yeah, mine doesn't even cover the costs from AdSense.
Mine will pay for... Because when I took up photography in effective professionally 2004, I came into some money. And I did two things with that. One was have a think seriously about what I want to do for a business. And the other bit was to pay off my mortgage, which is obviously because it was a mortgage taken out in 1986. I won't say you'd pay it off from loose change. It certainly wasn't.
But relative to today.
So that meant that I was able to look at the business from a long-term planning point of view. And that's why I'm very specific in what I do. I don't shoot babies, no weddings, no portraits, no dealing with the public. Because that was a choice when I set up the business. And I am immensely grateful that all my other skills got me to a point where I could go, yes, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, and I think, just looking back, because I think your YouTube AdSense income is very similar to mine per year. Now, what people probably don't see is, now I've got to pay for all of this before I pay myself.
Yes.
You haven't. Yours is pretty much all profit from YouTube.
It is indeed, yes.
And this is when I talk to people about overheads. Don't end up in the situation I'm in, because, I mean, say I made no other money apart from that. I'm assuming, I don't want to make too many assumptions, if you made that much money from AdSense, you'd be okay if you did nothing else.
I would be.
Not rich.
Not rich.
But you could survive the year.
Yes, because there's also the Northlight Images website, which I set up at similar time, for that. Now, before I took up YouTube, and I only took up the YouTube stuff in mid-2020, before that, the AdSense income from the website. Now, people who've got sufficiently, sufficiently old, will remember I set up the very first Canon Rumours site back in 2004, 2005, it was Pages then on a website. And the income from that, the AdSense income from that, pretty much tracks camera sales from 2004 to date. So you have a steady rise to when it peaked around about 2011. And this is, matches up, pretty much peaks around about then, when AdSense alone was bringing in £1,500 a month. And then it dropped off. Now, if you look at that curve and then look at sales of DSLRs, you'll see a similar curve. And that's when I realised about 2012 that this is not a long-term thing. So, yes, it paid for things, and that was great. But I ditched the Rumours pages. One of the reasons I ditched the Rumours pages was because there were xyzrumours.com sites opening up all over the place. Now, once there are loads and loads of these sites opening up, why am I bothering? I've got no great insights into this, so that's still there. But people who might know the Northlight Images website from years ago might remember the fact that it was, it had, as well as all the articles and stuff, it had Rumours pages.
I do remember it.
The pages are still there, and they occasionally get updated. But they're there for historic. My academic background coming out again.
Archive forever.
I don't like getting rid of pages.
Yes, absolutely. Now, before we wrap up, what I do want to talk about is cameras.
Ah, yes.
And because I've actually bought your book,
he says,
let me have it here so I can say it correctly. Photography with tilt shift. Can't even pronounce it properly. Shift lenses. Art and techniques. Now, for those on video, it's this one here. I ordered it off some website. It wasn't Amazon, though. It was a proper website.
Yeah.
And the reason I bought it was, despite having used tilt shift lenses for years, I was self-taught. And the problem with being self-taught is you don't know what you don't know.
Yes.
And I was like, well, I can do everything I need to do, but maybe there's better ways. Yeah. And maybe there's things I could be doing that are better. And at the time, I was using a 5DS and I had the 45mm?
TSC 45.
90mm and 135mm.
Well, that's the original 90.
Yes, you're still using today. And do you know what? When I got rid of them, the only reason I got rid of them was because I bought the Cambo system. So obviously in what you do, technical cameras, you can't really not use technical lenses or some sort of specialist lens is a must. Did you get a lens like that straight away when you bought your... Were they? Yeah, they were. No. These on film cameras,
yes, these go back. This particular one dates from the 1990s.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a TSE90. The new version of the TSE90, the macro is a better version of it. But this one works perfectly well on a GFX 100S. There's no problem whatsoever with that.
So you've got big image circles just to be able to do all the movements.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this one works great with this. Obviously, you get the 0.79 effective crop with that, but that doesn't make much difference. But using stuff like this, I didn't get first... If assume that I took up photography seriously when I turned pro in 2004, it wasn't until about 2006, 2007 that I started experimenting with tilt-shift lenses, and these would be the old Canon lenses, and decided I'm going to learn how to use these properly because I can see an advantage in using them. And then that progressed into getting ones for testing and stuff because of all the articles I've written over the years and articles and reviews. And then I was asked if I could write a book on them because somebody had said there is no book on just this subject.
Yes, Adams trilogy. What's it called? The negative,
the print, and the the camera and the print.
And that had it was like four lines.
Yeah,
and I was like, great, that's not much use. And then I bought another book, which again, it was a book about technical cameras.
Yeah,
and there was two pages on how the movements worked. And I was like, well, this is not helping me.
No,
I went onto YouTube. And the first video I watched was like, brilliant, that explains it all. I was like, it's not working. Found out it was incorrect information. And then I was like, geez, how hard is this? And then eventually I worked it out myself. And then, of course, when you're self-taught, you don't know what you don't know. So I bought the book probably a year ago.
Yeah, it's 2021, I think this is 2020.
I didn't know how old I bought it.
Was published a few years ago. It is, and this is what I say to people about books. This is a proper book where I was paid in advance.
Perfect.
And I receive royalties.
Oh, brilliant.
And it's gone past the advance was paid off. And once a year, I get a royalties check. And it's great because I know how much work went into actually putting it together. It's great. I'd written loads of articles on the website and things covering stuff like this, but to pull it all together into something like that that's useful to people.
Yeah.
And it's intent. So, for example, I call them tilt shift lenses. When I talk about movements in a lens, tilt is any direction. I never use swing. I don't use rise and fall or anything like that. It is shift and a direction, tilt and a direction, because the book is written for people who come from an ordinary 35mm camera background, not someone who knows technical cameras. If you know technical cameras, there may well be stuff useful, but this is written, and it's written without maths.
Yeah. Because I find a lot in photography, and I'm sure you've come up, like people are really pedantic about the words you use for things.
Oh, yes.
I'm just like, yeah, but I'm doing the same thing. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, you can call it a camera. You can call it a light box. You can call it a brick. It's a camera. Like, it doesn't matter.
Anything you like, but like, yes.
People are like, oh, that's technically not shift. What you've done, I'm like, but you know what I mean. Like, you're getting the results.
And it's not you've only got to get a few pages in, and there is a section in this that says, it is about shift, it is about tilt. I'm not using any of these other terms. Because if you think I should be using these other terms, you already know far more about the subject.
Yeah.
And it's almost free of maths as well.
Yes.
Because I originally, at university, I went to do astrophysics. So the maths and stuff, it's a distant memory now. But I know how much maths puts people off. And the more I know, more photographers I know, the less inclined I'm ever going to use much maths. So it's almost completely maths free.
Yeah, and I think in photography, you can either be incredibly technically minded or incredibly creatively minded.
Yeah.
And very few people span both ends of that. And I think it's playing to your strengths. If you don't understand the maths, don't go and try and learn it. No. It's not going to help you.
No.
But if you can understand the principle of what it means, then you're all good. And, you're talking about names. I don't use the correct words for tilt, shift, swing ever.
No.
I'm going to bend the lens. Yeah. I'm obviously not bending the lens. I'm just making it, you know. But in my head, it's like, it's bending.
Yeah. I'm thinking, you know, it's a simple, you know, where do I want the plane of focus to be? Why do I want the plane of focus to be a particular place? Yeah. You don't need to know much more about it than that. Shift is the easy one to understand.
Yeah.
Shift is the one I use for architectural photography almost all the time. Bit of vertical shift, bit of, whatever. That's the
I'll tell you what shocks me about shift is how a few millimetres of movement can move so much of an image.
Yes.
Like, it's always shocking how it's like, it does, except if you move the camera that much, it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it just always, every time I do it, I'm like, oh, that's quite a big difference.
Oh, yeah. I surprise myself sometimes with,
because we use it to get, so say we're shooting a drink or a cup of coffee that we've got in front of us. I'd be like, right, I want to see inside the cup of coffee, but I want to be coming from low down.
Yeah.
We can now achieve this. Yeah. Whereas with a normal camera, it's like, you can have one or the other.
Yes.
But there's quite a lot of, and I don't think people realise how many professional photographers use technical cameras or technical lenses. Because we're on a shoot next week, and I know for a fact the guy shooting on the Monday is using a technical camera.
Yeah.
I think it's a Sinar he's using with a Leaf back.
Yeah.
He said he has the Sinar back still, but the Digitech can't connect it.
Yeah,
because there's that scanner Sinar scanner. But Leaf are like, they got bought out, did they, or something by Phase? And
There were far more in that area than there are now.
And just for context, if you've got £1,000 to spend, we did this check the other day, you can buy a Phase 1 P645 body, the 80mm lens, and a Leaf back for less than you can buy a 5DSR.
Yeah.
Body,
yeah,
and the image quality will be substantially better, assuming you don't need autofocus to be banging.
Yes. This is a 1992 vintage lens, with an adapter on a GFX 100S. This lens works an absolute treat on this. If you've got the modern version of this lens, the newer TSE 90, absolutely stunning. In terms of quality. And I did see you showing one of your videos looking at the technical movements of a camera there. And almost everything you can do with one of those, you can do most of with one of these.
Oh, yeah. Like,
you can tilt the back. You can tilt all of the stuff like that. But it's still, it's the conceptual side of things of actually realizing that you're not just stuck with your camera in one place, just looking at something. You can move the camera and you can move the lens and all of those things.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I think the creative possibilities are just insane. It's, you know, like I say, you can have a drink looking from underneath it, but while seeing the top of it.
Yes.
You can look up at a hero angle, but have straight lines.
Yes.
All these things.
Which is what I do with buildings.
Yes, yeah. I think we do the opposite of what you do.
Yes.
So I think we try and make it look more wrong than it actually is, whereas you're making it look more right than it actually is. We're like, let's make this worse.
Shift is the easy one. All you do is, you take your horizon and move. I'll have horizon there. But and it came to me from wide-angle shots of landscape stuff and buildings. When I want the horizon low down, I do not want trees leaning in on either side like that.
Or
I want
to be up a step ladder with the camera.
I want the trees like that, but I don't want the horizon midway.
Yeah.
Oh, look, you can do it with a shift lens.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, I mean, I couldn't work without one anymore.
Yeah. I sometimes deliberately shoot without one to get me out of the habit of always thinking, how am I going to apply shift to do something like this, because I realized in working for architects, if I produce a picture of a building for an architect with the walls leaning in like that, an alarming angle, because I'm pointing the camera upwards, architects will shriek in horror at such things. However, architects for a practice may not be your prime client. Your client may actually be the marketing department.
And they want
a big practice.
Ridiculous look.
And they want what it is. You've got a choice of pictures. You'd either get a bang on vertical, everything straight and true, or at wacky angles. Slight lean, that's just careless.
Yeah.
Deliberate lean, the marketing people will love it.
Yeah.
The architects will go, ugh,
yeah,
nasty. But who's paying your bill?
And this is the thing, like, there are no wrong photographs. There's just wrong photographs of the wrong people.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, you know, any style's great for the right client.
Yes.
And it's just making sure that you have that right client in mind. But yeah, technical, I mean, like, I would never go back to using a standard camera ever again.
Yeah.
And the reason I use a technical camera, not a tilt shift, is one, because my items are closer.
Yes.
So I need more movement. They're not as far away.
Yeah.
And two, because I find a tilt shift lens too fiddly because it's quite small.
Yeah.
And it's much easier with a bigger setup. And I mean, one of my lenses from 1980s, 1970s.
Yeah.
They're better than most new lenses you can buy. Certainly
with the image circle.
Oh, yeah, the image circle. I've not found a dead spot in it yet. I've got a ridiculous extreme. I mean, the bellows actually caused the issue before the lens.
Yes.
Yeah. Although I had a load of people, you might know this, they're going, oh, you can't use a Canon 5D on one of those things there because of the flange distance or something like that. Loads of people. And I was like, right, well, I've used a 5D, I've used a Phase 1 IQ3 150, and I've used a Fuji. And I've had no issues with any of them. They all just seem to work fine.
There are limitations of them, of the lenses. So I know this TSE90, this is great, as long as I don't want to do much tilt of the lens at a wide aperture.
Yeah.
Then it becomes a creative lens.
Yes, which is funny because I first bought that lens when I was a portrait photographer.
Yeah.
And I shot it wide open all the time.
Yes.
And there's some cool, like, like...
It is. It's what you want it for.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I think have we covered everything?
Yeah, I think so.
I think we have. We've got we'll get the book in the show notes. We'll get your YouTube channel in the show notes. Because, you know, you discuss a lot of
printing. A lot of printing stuff. Somebody said to me, oh, you ought to be much more specific in what you cover. And I went, well, no, I cover what I'm interested in.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yes, you will get tilt-shift lenses. You will get macro stuff, that. But you'll also get the business of photography.
I've got,
you know, all sorts of bits. And it is the science of the bleeding obvious quite often. It is just that I come across a lot of photographers who just don't... They just seem to throw out any business experience. Yeah.
and out of interest, do you get many trolls on your YouTube channel or negative comments?
No, because I have a very strict approvals policy.
Oh, do you?
Anyone, I'm sorry for anyone this offends, but if you have a go at me on that, because I read every comment and I will reply to most comments, if you're being like that, it will disappear. I have no journalistic integrity to defend.
Yes,
of it.
Yeah.
You get what you get as part of the cost of, you know, in terms of you get me answering almost every comment because of that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting. So anyone can comment on mine. There's no approval thing for that.
Yeah.
I have blocked a couple of people when they've used their real names as their thing and said really bad stuff, and their photographer, and I'm like, I don't think they realise.
Do you really
that
want
they will
to
come up on a Google search now?
Yes,
and because that is their Google account, which is linked to their website, and I'm like, you don't
want to say that.
Yeah, no. Like really, like horrible things. No. I get the odd death threat.
I get occasional people tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
But their comment never sees the light of day. I have no problem.
I leave them out there for all to see.
It's my channel.
Yeah.
It's there. It takes an editorial policy that is my editorial policy. If you don't like it, well, there you go.
Yeah, see, I leave everyone to comment everything. I mean, a lot of them get automatically blocked. Have you found the blocked feature? There's like a separate tab.
Oh, yeah.
So there's two. So if you go to held for review,
you
scroll down to the bottom, there's a bit that if you click there, that's where all the bad ones are.
I have approval of any comment.
Ah,
so no comment ever appears on mine without it being approved.
I don't think I could cope with that.
It's because I started it that way.
Yes.
I've got a way of dealing with it.
Yeah, and I just leave it. I mean, I've shadow banned a few people who just leave like annoying comments in every video. I'm like, I don't need to read that.
Yeah.
It's like, don't like your title. Don't like your thumbnail. I'm just like, I don't care. like, yeah. go somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I just shadow banned them. They can keep commenting forever.
The point is that the comments, certainly on my YouTube channel, I intend the comments to be useful for
yes.
people. So I take a time putting references in, answers, links yeah. to articles, stuff like that. And if you don't like that, there are plenty of other channels.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, like, I used to reply to all the comments.
Yeah.
But now you can tell when I've gone to the gym, because when I go to the gym is when I read YouTube comments. So, like, I've been ill for 2 weeks. There's been no responses to any YouTube comments. Yeah. But then, like, next week when I'm back in the gym again, there'll be YouTube. I don't respond to it. I used to respond to every comment.
Yeah.
And then I realised how much time it was taking up. Yeah. So now what I do is, like, I'll be doing bench.
Yeah.
Do 8 reps, 2 minutes rest, just reply to some comments. I don't reply to silly comments, but anyone yeah. who's, like, got a no, genuine, like...
Serious stuff.
Yeah. And if it's a good comment, yeah. I'll make a video about it.
Yeah. It is, yeah. If an answer takes, you know, to me, if someone emails me with a question and it runs to a second paragraph or a long paragraph, that is the outline script for another video.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, but yeah, I think anyone who, like, I've got some people that whinge about every video.
Yeah.
I'm like, just stop watching them. Do us both a favour, stop watching them.
I just go, bye.
Yeah, well, I've started shadow banning some of them now because it's like every video.
Yeah.
So I preferred it when you made videos like this. I'm like, well, I don't care because I don't make them for you.
Yeah.
Like, I preferred it when it was like, well, I don't like it when you do this. Well, I don't agree with you. I'm like, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Be constructive criticism, I'm okay with.
Yeah, someone's complaining about the microphones being in our faces. So I've tried a different setup instead of stands, but I think they're just about as bad.
Okay, yeah, that one there. Oh, yes. Well, yeah. There we go.
But, you know, I'm right on the edge of frame as well, because I swung my way out here like this. And probably half the video not even in the shot. But,
yeah,
you know, it's a podcast. It's not really for YouTube. It's for audio. And we can't have good audio
without
good video,
proper microphones.
Perfect audio is like this. And if we did this, everyone would go absolutely mad. So we've done a bit of a compromise of okay audio and sort of like,
yeah.
We should try to make it work.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'll see. Anyway, thank you so much for your time. We'll have to do some proper
yes.
videos together. Maybe we should print some stuff.
Ooh.
I don't know how we'd do that, but maybe we should do like a full shoot to print.
Well, I would say something that I get asked a lot about is upcoming new printers.
Yep.
And the one that everybody is asking me about at the moment in terms of good quality printers is the replacement for the Canon Pro 1000. Been around for a while. Yes, it is coming. I do not know at the moment when it will appear. You may take that as meaning I haven't signed an NDA on it.
Yeah.
And I haven't got one at home. But people who want, you know, printing
yeah, yeah.
is one of the things. I do a lot of work with the likes of Epson and Canon. So, yeah.
Yeah, we're just having a new book printed at the moment, actually, a portfolio book. And everyone's like, should I get my book printed? I'm like, not until you're definitely certain your work's good and you're well-established.
Yeah.
Guess how much it costs of a portfolio book printed at the moment?
Grand.
Inbound. $2,500 per book. I've got
ouch.
I need three of them, one for each of my agents and one for myself.
Ouch.
Yeah. Like, that's a big investment.
Yeah.
Ooh. It's that's why I don't have fancy cameras. Well, I do like Reddit, but that's why I haven't got a phase one for some $7,500 on books.
Yeah.
I better get a booking off the back of those. Otherwise, I'll be a... And you can't even put the video in the book. So I've got to have an iPad still anyway. It's pointless. But there we go. There we go. Anyway, we'll leave it there. We'll wrap it up. And we'll, we'll see you all in the next episode.
Well, thanks for asking us.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, now let's do the bit where we make sure we don't delete all the photos when you take the photos.